Welcome to Role-Playing History, the podcast where we explore the history of role-playing games. I'm Wayne Davis, and I'll be your guide for today's tour. Episode 55, The World of Darkness. Before we jump into today's tour, I wanted to take a moment to respond to a few comments I got about last week's episode. I got a number of messages from listeners pointing out that I missed defining how hit points are determined, also what death saving throws are, or any one of a number of other questions that folks wanted the answer to that I didn't think of when I was putting together that show. So I've made a list of those questions, and when I think we've got enough terms together, we'll either do another episode of this show, or I'll do a YouTube exclusive and I'll cover some more terms there. So with that covered, today we're going to do a deep dive on the World of Darkness, which encompasses a number of different games and technically consists of two separate series of books. The World of Darkness, which was published between 1991 and 2002, and The Chronicles of Darkness, which was first published in 2004 and is still the primary line being published today. Sort of. See, both the dates I laid out and what's being published and when and why are a bit fluid, but I'll try to help nail down a structure for all of this as we move along. However, players commonly and frequently use the term World of Darkness for any of the books in either line, so that's why this episode got the title that it got. And with a bit of explanation out of the way, let's crank up the tour bus and get this deep dive rolling. The World of Darkness series started from the mind of one man, Mark Rhine Hagen. Mark was working at White Wolf Publishing in 1990 and began development on the game that would be his follow-up to 1987's Ars Magica. The concept Mark came up with at the time was to release one game book in the line every year for 5 years. Now, I'm not a game creator, but that seems like a hell of a lot of pressure to put on somebody, let alone yourself. I mean, we're talking about creating rules, writing a book, playtesting, getting the printing all laid out. Even for a fellow as talented as Mark Rhine Hagen, that was a pretty tall order. Vampire the Masquerade was the first release in the line, coming out in 1991, and it was followed by Werewolf the Apocalypse in 1992, Mage the Ascension in 1993, Wraith the Oblivion in 1994, and Changeling the Dreaming in 1995. So he made his goal, right? Well, remember when I mentioned just a moment ago that 5 games in 5 years was a tall order? Yeah. While the games were wildly successful, drawing not only the attention of players but also the industry as a whole, there was an overall problem that plagued these books. Frequently, the first editions of the game were exceptionally flawed. And I don't just mean a couple of printing errors here or there. Reports over the years have claimed that some books were missing chunks of rules that were needed, while some were poorly laid out or had other issues. If you've got a first printing of any of the books I just mentioned, flip through it and keep a count of the number of errors you find. It will probably astound you. The workaround for this was to print new, revised editions of these core rulebooks. Between 1993 and 2000, multiple editions of each of those 5 books were published, and the gaming public couldn't seem to get enough. It should also be noted that Mage the Ascension saw bigger adjustments than its 4 siblings in the series due to the multiple editions, and that's mostly because its themes changed over time. It's also worth noting that at the creation of the World of Darkness, Ars Magica was tied to the line. That would make sense, since, as I mentioned before, Mark Rhine Hagen was the creator of that game as well. I think I've mentioned this in a previous episode or two, but I'll repeat it here just in case. Ars Magica's place in the World of Darkness was initially to provide the historical backdrop for the 5 titles in the line. There was also the ability to bring some of the game style of Ars Magica into the World of Darkness, but most players were encouraged to just go with the ideas that were presented in the core books. Ars Magica was sold to Wizards of the Coast in 1994, and all references to the history that game provided to the World of Darkness was quickly scrubbed from future editions. However, there are still a couple of remnants of Ars Magica in the World of Darkness. House Tremere was reused as a vampire clan in Vampire the Masquerade, and the Order of Aramis is a mage tradition in Mage the Ascension. Another fun fact about the first 5 books in the World of Darkness line is that Mark Rhine Hagen wrote the first 4 by himself. His stated style for doing this was to write 1 book, finish it, then immediately start on the next. Now, I have to admire him for doing that for 4 years straight, as I have issues trying to write 2 podcasts a week, and I can assure you I write way fewer words than I'm sure he was doing at the time. The one book he didn't write was Mage the Ascension, and its designers were Stuart and Steve Week, along with Chris Early. For the record, the Weeks were the founders of White Wolf Studios, which we covered in a previous episode of the podcast, and that's available in the archives. Of course, when you've got that many different lines out at one time, one designer, or even 3 in the case of Mage, can't be expected to keep up with everything that's going on with the line. So with that in mind, White Wolf brought in new staff to manage the titles. Among them were Andrew Greenberg, who came in to oversee Vampire, and Bill Bridges, who was assigned the Werewolf line. Over the years, their input helped to shape the overall look and feel of the titles. Mark Ryan Hagen's time with White Wolf came to an end in 1996, and it coincided with a downturn in profits for the World of Darkness. According to multiple sources, the primary reason for the loss of profits was a large number of bookstore returns of novelizations of the World of Darkness, and we'll get into the books in those lines another time. For the purposes of this part of the discussion, the issues with economics led to issues between Ryan Hagen and the Weeks. Pretty easy to figure out who was going to win that argument. With the line's creator gone, White Wolf decided to change its focus and style for the games moving forward. They chose a more historical style of setting for the lines, with Vampire the Dark Ages, released in 1996, Werewolf the Wild West in 1997, and Mage the Sorcerer's Crusade in 1998. However, the previous World of Darkness magic touch only applied to Vampire the Dark Ages. It sold well, but the other two didn't, and that led to more changes in the World of Darkness. Getting a bit ahead of ourselves, the primary victim of the lack of sales was the Wraith line, which was shut down after it got its own historical release, Wraith the Great War, plus a 1999 supplement, Ends of Empire. After that, Wraith would be no more. Now, backing up a couple of years, in 1997, White Wolf decided to try another creation release model for the World of Darkness. This time, they decided to release a game that would require another book from within the line in order to play. So the TLDR on this basically means that they went with a Savage Worlds concept, whereby you release a game system, then release a setting style game within it. Not quite exactly the same, but close. The overall thought behind this release style is that you can release a title, tie it into another title in your line, and not have to support the former title with supplements. 3 releases followed this pattern. Mummy's Second Edition, which came out in 1997, Kindred of the East, which released in 1998, and Mummy the Resurrection, which came out in 2001. However, White Wolf wasn't done with modern-day settings for games. Hunter the Reckoning came out in 1999, and Demon the Fallen followed in 2002. Once those 2 were released, White Wolf went back to historical settings for their titles. Victorian Age Vampire and Dark Ages Vampire followed Demon's release. Dark Ages Vampire was a new edition of Vampire Dark Ages, and it led a line of Dark Ages releases that spanned the line. Again, White Wolf stuck to the formula that all of the Dark Ages books would require a main game's rulebook to be played. In this case, if you had Dark Ages Vampire, you had the book you needed to be able to play any other game in the Dark Ages line once you picked up that second book. There was one final title in the line, Orpheus, which was considered to be a sequel to the Wraith line, released in 2003. However, with sales falling across the line, White Wolf decided to end the series. However, much like we've seen in the world of superhero comics, they decided to do a major event that fell across all of the titles in the line. In 2004, White Wolf announced The Time of Judgment, which was a line of books designed to end the overarching narratives of Vampire, Werewolf, Mage, Changeling, Demon, Hunter, Kindred of the East, and Mummy. Once everything for The Time of Judgment had been released, White Wolf decided to reboot the World of Darkness, again, much like superhero comic book lines, and later in 2004 released the rulebook, The World of Darkness. Once they did that, they started releasing new books in the line that had updated storytelling system rules and a brand new setting to be utilized. Vampire the Requiem was the first book in this line, and it released in 2004. 2005 saw Werewolf the Forsaken and Mage the Awakening. Don't worry, we'll be covering all of these games as we continue to deep dive the World of Darkness, I'm just taking the time here to give the overall timeline of the system before we dive into individual games. That's why I said last week I could see this being a two-part show. In 2006, CCP Games, a video game developer based in Iceland, acquired White Wolf Publishing and all of their intellectual properties. The idea at the time was that CCP would create an online video game adaptation of the entire World of Darkness series. For a while, though, the various titles in the line kept being printed and sold, with some supplemental materials released as well. However, at some point, CCP began transferring staff from the White Wolf publishing side of the business and into the video game development side, and that brought tabletop production to a virtual halt. CCP had one final book in the World of Darkness line to publish and distribute, and it was 2011's release of Vampire the Masquerade 20th Anniversary Edition. By the way, this was an update of the pre-reboot game, as the title would indicate. Later in 2011, CCP laid off huge chunks of their staff, which meant tabletop games had little to no staff left to create and publish. However, White Wolf Publishing's creative director, Rich Thomas, wasn't going to let the line die. He formed a new company, Onyx Path Publishing, and licensed both lines of World of Darkness, and he got back to producing new content for the game. Anniversary editions were at the forefront of the new releases, with each of the first five books in the line having anniversaries, one right after the other. Onyx Path would also produce some new games, like Mummy the Curse in 2013 and Demon the Descent in 2014. However, those two titles, along with some of the anniversary books, used crowdfunding to finance their publications, as while Onyx Path had the money to license the line, resources to actually print the books was pretty slim. So, in 2015, White Wolf Publishing and its various properties were sold again. This time, the Swedish game publisher Paradox Interactive was the destination. When Paradox acquired White Wolf, they made the name change from World of Darkness to Chronicles of Darkness and applied the new name to the post-reboot titles of the series, which is why there's some debate over when the Chronicles of Darkness actually began. Let the debates begin. After the show, please, if you don't mind. Paradox's stated reason for changing the game was to avoid confusion due to there being two different series of books with two different settings, yet having the exact same name. And before the name change, many players and writers distinguished the difference by calling one the Old or Classic World of Darkness, and the other the New World of Darkness. Almost like New World Order, but we're not going to get into that. There was a casualty of the Paradox acquisition. Onyx Path had been developing Vampire the Masquerade 4th Edition when the sale was finalized. Paradox canceled that title and decided to release their own Vampire the Masquerade title, this one referred to as 5th Edition. Released in 2018, the game started a firestorm of controversy. Let's start with the fact that the game included copious references to neo-Nazis. Add to that the fact that there was a character in the book who was indicated to be a pedophile. Those two points led a whole lot of gamers throughout the community to accuse Paradox of catering to neo-Nazi groups. White Wolf Publishing denied any intentional neo-Nazi slant to their game, and they apologized for the content. However, the shitstorm continued. The Vampire the Masquerade sourcebooks included the use of the real-world anti-gay purges in Chechnya as the backdrop for some of the fictional events in the books. Yeah. White Wolf went two for two following the Book of Bad Ideas here, and it wouldn't go unchecked after this. Paradox Interactive's Vice President of Business Development called the two incidents using the materials in a crude and disrespectful way. The company as a whole integrated White Wolf Publishing directly into the parent company, which hadn't happened under CCP, made major changes to the leadership, which also hadn't happened under CCP, and finally, Paradox made the decision to suspend sales and printings of the new Vampire the Masquerade books, and they halted development across the entire line. This seemed to quell and satisfy the gaming community, which I can remember at the time being pretty much up in arms across the board with this version of the game, which had additional materials many found to be offensive, but I'm not going to get into that here. I mean, I think I made my point with the stuff I did lay out. Once Paradox had an opportunity to review Vampire the Masquerade and remove all of the offending materials, Paradox then decided to hand the line over to a new licensee, Modiphius Entertainment, to rebuild the books and rebuild the line. Modiphius decided to bring in folks who really understood the game, and they brought in Onyx Path Publishing to collaborate and consult as they fixed the game. In 2020, Vampire the Masquerade Companion was released. As a part of that, Paradox introduced more changes to how the series would be handled moving forward. Justin Achille would be the creative lead, and Paradox would be developing all of the core books in-house. Renegade Game Studios would be handling the development of all other game materials for the line. Paradox also announced that all World of Darkness development moving forward would involve sensitivity reviewers to ensure respectful portrayal of themes and topics. One more note here. As a part of the above announcements, Paradox also announced that their World of Darkness team would be coordinating with all of the external developers, including the video game developers, to ensure cohesion and continuity through all the World of Darkness materials. Now, let's dive into the various non-tabletop World of Darkness items. And actually, I'm going to do this as a short dive. Because this short version, it's been in video games, card games, board games, the Mind's Eye Theater series of live-action role-playing games, a ton of novels, fiction anthologies, comics, the 1996 TV series, Kindred the Embraced, the actual play web series, LA by Night, Seattle by Night, Vain Pursuit, and The Nightlife. By the way, those live play series are still going on, so check them out on YouTube and Twitch. You are welcome. It should also be noted that deals are in the works for both a motion picture and a television franchise based on the line, so there's more stuff on the way. Now, I could, and I probably should, get into the specifics of this, but seeing how we're already well over 10 pages and about 3,000 words of script, and I haven't even gotten into a single game in the line, I think we'll leave the specifics of the ancillaries for another time. If we're deep diving the games in the World of Darkness line, we have to start with the game that started it all. Vampire the Masquerade. So we know from our overview of the World of Darkness that Mark Reinhagen developed the game and the first edition was published in 1991. However, what we didn't discuss earlier was Reinhagen's influences in creating the game. In multiple interviews over the years, he's admitted to being influenced by Call of Cthulhu, RuneQuest, and Nightlife. He was also influenced by the writings of Joseph Campbell, as well as vampire films, with the Lost Boys being a flick he name-dropped on more than one occasion. He has also stated more than once that he didn't read any of Anne Rice's Vampire Chronicles until he was really deep into the development process. But he also concedes that her works were probably an influence on the various films he himself had been influenced by, so her works probably also influenced the overall product. Reinhagen's stated goal in creating Vampire was to not create a game where the characters hunted vampires. He felt that would get boring for the players. So he turned the concept around and decided to create a game where the players played the vampires themselves, and decided to go beyond what Anne Rice was doing with the vampires, with his focus being on developing an entire vampire society, which would be secret, of course, and further developing an entire vampire culture. And while many designers would have made it a point to avoid religion at all costs, Reinhagen didn't. Well, that's not entirely true. At first, he admits he was trying to keep religion out of the game. However, as the son of a Lutheran minister, that was going to be hard to do. It became even more difficult when Stuart Week gave him a comic book. Inspired by both, Reinhagen decided that the biblical figure Cain was the original vampire. Once he made that creative decision, he admitted in a Reddit AMA that he was all in, especially since with his decision on Cain, he could now draw a line from any vampires in his game all the way back to their source. It needs to be mentioned that Vampire was a wholly different idea for a game when it came out. I mean, sure, players actually playing vampires instead of the characters hunting them was a pretty novel idea, but it was more than that. The concept of linking different games into the same game world was a pretty novel idea, and the design of the first book was novel as well. A single rose on green marble. Simple, elegant, and it drew a lot of attention. One more major difference was Vampire's focus on plot, story, and interpersonal relationships with all of the baggage that those come with. Intrigue, deception, and all the interesting ideas that can come from those were also encouraged. This meant that Vampire was focused on being a more narrative game rather than a combat-focused dungeon crawl. While horror-themed games had been virtually unable to sell in the broader market previously, Reinhagen added elements to his game that gave it a more dark superhero vibe. His vampires had the opportunity to have supernatural powers like superior strength, speed, and toughness, or mystic senses, mind control, or blood magic. Taking all of these powers, called disciplines in the game, into account, Vampire was set up to be a success. If the mechanics could be worked out, that is. Ryan Hagen called on the services of Tom Dowd, who co-designed Shadowrun, which had been released in 1989 and was a big success. Dowd utilized many of the same mechanics that had driven Shadowrun, specifically the comparative dice pool idea. Dowd changed the die type from a D6 to a D10 and otherwise left that part of the system as it was. Looking into skills and skill values, the idea of a skill value that determined the number of dice a player would roll was not a new idea. Games like Champions had used that system before. However, Dowd made another genius alteration. Instead of adding all the dice rolled together, which all the previous systems had done, in Vampire, the result of the dice would be compared to a fixed value, which would determine the degree of success or failure. Balancing this change in the system, Dowd determined that the skill levels would be fairly low, ranging from 1 to 5, and would be represented with dots on the character sheet. This was another change for the norm, as skill values in most of the other games were represented with numbers. So what this did overall was further emphasize the narrative style of play by removing a complex system of mechanics from the game and allowing for skill checks to, in theory, move smoother and quicker than in other games, like D&D. One unexpected result was that characters that were highly skilled could experience a catastrophic failure in their check if their rolls were just that bad. Furthermore, a character who wasn't very well skilled could get lucky and pull off the success of successes. In my opinion, that just makes the system that much more real. Now, we pretty much covered the publication history of Vampire earlier in this episode and in our episode about White Wolf, but let's take a quick moment to check out the release timeline for Vampire. We mentioned the 1991 release of the first edition more than once. I'm going to leave that there. Second edition came out in 1992, and it was a part of those revisions and reprints I mentioned earlier in the show due to issues with the content. It got a revised edition in 1998, the aforementioned 20th anniversary edition in 2011, and the controversial 5th edition in 2018. I do want to add a couple things to this timeline. The revised 5th edition was released on Roll20 in June of 2021, and in July of 2021, Renegade Game Studios released reprinted editions of the 5th edition core rulebook and supplements. Also, there's supposed to be an online tool set called World of Darkness Nexus coming by the end of 2022. I scoured the interwebs for more information, but I don't have a firm release date as of this recording. Okay, so let's get into the meat and potatoes of a good game, how it's played, and what coolness was built into the setting. The game uses the cursed condition of vampires to play on the universal themes of morality, depravity, the human condition, well, the appreciation of the human condition in reality, salvation, and personal horror. The World of Darkness is just that, dark, gloomy, bleak. That doesn't mean there's no color or happiness in the game. It just means that as these characters are doomed to their condition, they see the world far differently than humans would. The basic idea for a vampire in the game is to retain your sense of self, humanity, and sanity. Of course, that's not going to be easy, since both mortal and supernatural beings are out to kill you. And if they don't, you might not survive the politics and backstabbing of the various vampire clans in the game. In truth, I've personally found the game to be way more exhilarating and exciting than I just laid out, but I do admit that the themes can be pretty frickin' dark. In other words, this game is definitely not a game for little kiddos. As I've mentioned multiple times before, Vampire is based on the storyteller system, which I've hit on a couple of different times during the course of this series. What it really means is that the system is supposed to be more about the interplay and interactions and less about the combat. Obviously, there's more to it than that, but what I said works for our purposes today. Now, to meld the vampire experience into the storyteller system, the game has a few extra mechanics. First of all, a vampire has a blood pool, which indicates the amount of human blood, referred to as vitae, or vitae, depending on your pronunciation, that's currently in their body. One cool thing about vitae is that it can be used to power abilities and do some supernatural tricks. Again, this is based on the vampire flicks Mark Ryan Hagen was inspired by. Vampires also have humanity scores. Humanity indicates how closely in touch with their human nature they still are. Needless to say, you want this score to stay high because the lower it gets, the greater the chance your beast, or the feral side of your soul that lives on rage, hunger, and hatred of God and humanity, takes over. If that score ever reaches zero, you enter the state of constant frenzy called wassail, or wassail, and the storyteller takes over your character. Things that can lower your humanity score are brutal and immoral actions. I don't think I need to spell things out on that because you can probably come up with better things than I can, or worse things depending on how you want to look at it. Let's see, I mentioned the D10 dice pool system a few minutes ago, so I'm not going to repeat it here, though I guess I just did. I have to admit that for all of the creative things that Ryan Hagen did in Vampire, he did lean on some vampire tropes. Sunlight is dangerous to vampires and potentially deadly. A wooden stake through the heart, while a trope, doesn't kill them, though it does immobilize them until it can be removed. So, stake a vampire out on the front lawn right about daybreak, you get the picture. The beast, as I just mentioned a moment ago, is probably the biggest weakness that vampires have. I'm going to skip over a further explanation of Vitae and the process of the embrace. The process of the embrace is how vampires are created in the game. It's interesting, but there's a lot of stuff there, and we're already starting to run out of time. So I want to explain the concept of the Masquerade, because it's in the title of the game. The Masquerade is an organized conspiracy primarily designed by the Camarilla, who we'll discuss in a bit, to convince the public that vampires do not exist. The Camarilla believes that the Masquerade is the foundation for the survival of kindred, that's the term vampires use to describe their species to each other, and believe that without it, the kine, or kine, depending on your pronunciation, it's the term for humans, would rise up and pull a mass blade event, basically, on all the undead. Obviously, disclosing or exposing the fact that vampires actually exist is a big no-no and is even codified in the first tradition, which reads, "Thou shalt not reveal thy true nature to those not of the blood. Doing such shall renounce thy claims of blood." All right. So the Masquerade is supposed to be maintained through self-policing, but the game itself indicates that the prince in Camarilla-controlled areas will enforce it themselves. By enforce, read, kill whoever broke it. At least that's been true in my experience. But we couldn't have a big rule without somebody wanting to break it, right? In Vampire, the Sabbat don't uphold the enforcement portion of the deal, but they do tend to work within themselves to try to contain any breaches of the Masquerade. Note the key word there, try. So you can already see how societal issues can come into play as you play the game. Speaking of society, let's take a look at it. Age plays a large part in social distinction with vampires. More to the point, younger vampires are finding themselves constantly having to prove themselves to the older ones, especially as it pertains to earning respect and power. I'm going to cover the age groups used in the games, but I do need to point out that these are rather loosely utilized in the game. These titles basically are descriptors of a vampire's development and aren't really seen to be titles or jobs or yada yada. Fledglings are newly embraced vampires who haven't yet entered vampire society on a formal basis. They are considered too ignorant and weak to survive on their own. Neonates are young, relatively speaking, vampires, but they've proven the ability to survive on their own and thus are now seen as a full-fledged member of society. Ancilla, or Ancia, depending on your pronunciation, they've been around anywhere from a few decades to a few centuries, give or take. They've probably accomplished something pretty significant for their sect or clan, but that's up to the storyteller to decide along with the player. Elder. For the purposes of this description, think anywhere from 200 to 1,000 years old. These vampires have the wealth, influence, and power to be players throughout vampire society. And if they don't have all three, they certainly have at least one. Methuselah. That's between 1,000 and 2,000 years old. You're probably not going to run into a lot of these because the rules of the game have them pretty much moving back into the shadows and removing themselves from society. Some go quite mad and others just can't survive the changes being this old brings. Antediluvian. Supposedly there's only 13 of these in the world. These are the vampires of the third generation who are descended from Cain's original children. Do with that information what you will. Vampires in the game are also separated into sects and clans. That's sects and clans. Get your mind out of the gutter. Sects are rather complex, and while I'll name them here, I can't do them justice with the amount of time I've got left to get into them. Check out a copy of Vampire the Masquerade and see what I mean. The sects are the Camarilla, the Anarch Movement, the Sabbat, the Inkanu, Tal Machera, and the Independents. Clans are the vampire's family. There's 13 of them, and each was supposedly founded by one of the 13 original vampires. Again, I'm just going to list them here because a full description could damn near be an episode of its own. Banu Hakim, which was Asimite prior to 5th edition, Bruja, Gangrel, Hectata, which was the Giovanni prior to 5th edition, La Sombra, Macavian, the Ministry, formerly the followers of Set, Nosferatu, Ravnos, Toreador, Tremere, Smissi, and Ventru. So as you can see, Vampire the Masquerade has a rich background for players and storytellers to utilize in their games, and lots of different options for character creation. There's a ton more stuff I could have covered here, and maybe I should have made Vampire its own episode, but since I committed to this, I'm going to keep moving. In 1991, Vampire the Masquerade was one of the top 10 best-selling tabletop role-playing games in the United States. It has also won multiple awards over the years and was a 2007 inductee into the Origins Awards Hall of Fame. Now, normally at this point in a podcast, which is about 18 and a half pages and about 5,300 words in, I'd be looking to wrap up the tour and promote next week's show. But with the mound of material I still have to cover on the World of Darkness, we're going to take a peek at one more game today, time limits be damned. Werewolf the Apocalypse was designed by Mark Reinhagen and released in 1992. 2 years later, it got a second edition for much the same reason as the rest of the original five, which I've discussed multiple times during the show. It got another revised edition in 2000, plus a 20th anniversary edition in 2013. Also, according to multiple reports, a fifth edition of this game is in the works, though a possible release date has not come out yet. Now, the beauty of having multiple games that utilize the exact same mechanics means we can save some time in our deep dive, since I don't have to go over those again here. Just refer back to my comments on system mechanics in the section about Vampire the Masquerade, and those will apply in this case as well. This means we get the rest of the time we've got today to get into the nitty-gritty of Werewolf, which is the gameplay and background inside the game itself. The basic premise of the game is that the players are playing Garou, which is the term used for were-creatures. Oh, and I say were-creatures because not all of the characters will be werewolves, and we'll discuss that further in just a minute. The theory is that the PCs will have undergone some training as Garou and passed their initiation rite, known as the Rite of Passage. With that complete, they are considered to be at the Kliath rank, and we'll discuss that in a minute as well. At this point, the PCs would form their own pack and work together to gain renown and deal with issues in the game that need to be dealt with. This will allow them to advance in rank over time. Since we know that Werewolf takes place in the same fictionalized version of Earth that Vampire does, we should also note that werewolves are just one of the supernatural beings wandering around, as it's assumed vampires are also around, along with some other nasties. The thing is, though, werewolves, much like vampires, are trying to stay hidden from prying public eyes. Their existence is supposed to be a secret from humans. Of course, they're doing this because they're trying to prevent the apocalypse from happening, and they'll kill anyone, human or supernatural, that they believe are trying to make the apocalypse a reality. Again, I think it's safe to say this is not a game for the kiddos. The game hits on a lot of themes, including the inability of Garou to live as or among humans, plus the duality of their human and other halves. The werewolf game has a rich history, which is fully detailed in the rulebook. Again, I'd get into that here, but I'd rather spend time going over some of the other things about the game with the time we've got left. Suffice to say, if you've got access to a copy of the book, it's a hell of a read. Now, in the world of werewolf, lycanthropy is an inherited trait, which means were creatures aren't made, they're born. What that also means for the game is that the characters are born with their traits. However, they don't manifest until the character goes through what's described as the first change, which is an event that tends to happen during puberty that causes the latent abilities to surface. Think Teen Wolf, only as a horror movie instead of as a comedy. That would be for my generation, thank you very much. Now, when creating characters, there's a choice for the storyteller to decide. Do the characters know that Garou exists, or are they effectively orphans who need to be discovered by Garou? Also, who are their parents? I mean, yeah, they're going to want to figure out some of that as part of their background, but I mean something different right now. See, there are three archetypes players can use to determine how their character was born. In game terms, this is called breed.
A Garou's parents are typically a Garou and a non-Garou human, or a Garou and a wolf with a strong Garou heritage known as kinfolk. Garou with human parentage are called Hamid, and Garou of wolf parentage are Lupus. There is also the option to play as a Metis, but that's a Garou born of two Garou parents. And while that sounds cool for your players, it's probably not going to be. Because in this case, the Garou is born already transformed, they are infertile and deformed, and the birth typically results in the death of the mother. See what I mean? Garou also have the ability to shapeshift into and out of five different forms. See, you thought there were only two, human and werewolf. Hamid is the human form, which makes them look just like humans, for the most part. Glabro is a near-human form. Think Neanderthal, but taller than the Garou's usual human form. Krynos is the werewolf form. It's monstrous, usually 9 feet tall and built of rock-solid muscle. Ispo is a massive direwolf form. And Lupus is the wolf form, which grants certain abilities from the wolf that the human form wouldn't have. Shifting from Hamid to Krynos is, mechanically speaking, a fairly easy task. However, shifting to any of the other forms can be a little more difficult to do. And if I didn't just drop enough terminology on you, here comes some more. During creation, the player needs to choose an archetype for their character. They're known as auspices, and it defines the lunar phase the character was born under. Ragabash are Garou born under the new moon. They're called the Questioner of Ways. Thurj are born under the waxing or waning crescent moon. They're called the Searcher of Ways. Philodox are born under the quarter or half moons, and they are called the Keeper of the Ways. Galliard are born under waxing or waning gibbous moons. They are the Lover of Ways. And Alron are born under the full moon. They are the Protector of the Ways. Now, obviously, auspices have a bit more than just neat titles to them. They also give ideas about how to play the character, as well as a look at how they're seen in Garou society. In-game, if the players perform acts that fit within their auspice, the character should be advancing in rank and renown. So, we talked about clans and sects in Vampyr. Well, Werewolf has tribes. As of the most recent edition of the game, there are 13 tribes. There used to be 16, but three of them are noted to have since become extinct. These are the Black Furies, all female, the Bone Gnawers, they live in the slums, the Children of Gaia, pacifists, the Fianna, Celtic, the Get of Fenris, Germanic, the Glasswalkers, most in tune with the Weaver, the Red Talons, Lupus only, the Shadow Lords, Slavic, the Silent Striders, Egyptian, the Silver Fangs, they're considered the leaders of Garou society. The Stargazers, they're Hindu. The Utena, Native Americans, sort of. The Wendigo, younger brothers to Native Americans. There are also some groups that operate outside of the Garou nation, and they are Ronin, Garou who've been expelled from Garou society. The Sibarak, they're disavowed. The Skin Dancers, disenfranchised kinfolk who learned a forbidden dance that allows them to become Garou after killing five of them. Right on. I mentioned that there are other types of werebreeds out there, and there are, and I'm going to get to them in like a second here. However, the rules tend to lean more towards these being adversaries of the Garou. But this is a personal one. The last game of Werewolf I played in allowed for these different types of were creatures and all of you being part of the same tribe, as it were. So I say, go with what works for you. All right, here we go. The Ajaba, they're were-hyenas. The Anasazi are were-spiders. Bastet, were-cats. Korax are were-ravens. Gural, were-bears. Kitsune, were-foxes. Mokol or Mokole, were-reptiles. Naga, were-snakes. Nuisha, were-coyotes. Ratkin, I think you figured that one out. Were rats. And Rokea, were sharks. Yes, were sharks exist. Dig it. There's a lot more description provided for these in the text, but again, I wanted to get the basics out there so you'd understand what you had to work with. I'm going to lay off of reviews this episode, primarily because Vampyr and Werewolf both were fairly well reviewed. And with that, hey, we've come to the end of today's show. So next week, we continue our tour of the World of Darkness, and we'll see just how many game titles we can cover in a single episode. That could get interesting. While you're in the podcast mood, I encourage you to check out our other show, Bad GM's Campaign Build Along. We're using the Deadlands classic game, and we've built a town, created a sample character to show how the process works, and we've been creating scenarios for you to use in your game. And since my home group is playing this game at present, you get campaign recaps where we discuss how my group played what we have created. That's Bad GM's Campaign Build Along, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts. The music we use for this show comes from Pixabay.com. Check them out for all your license-free, royalty-free music needs. Role-Playing History is a production of Bad GM Productions, and normally I'd be going through all the places you could follow us on, but I need to make a confession. I know the YouTube and Twitch channels, along with the website, are not up and running yet, and I know I've been giving this spiel for 10 weeks now. I can give you 1,000 reasons why they're not done, but in my mind, they'd really just be excuses. All I can tell you is that YouTube and Twitch should have the content by the end of the weekend, and the website will be up and running as soon as my tech guru gets freed up from his other obligations, and they are serious obligations, but he will get it done as soon as he can, I promise you. And I do appreciate your patience during this period. I did put all the ways you can follow us in the information box for this episode, so check us out there. Next week, we continue our look at the World of Darkness with part 2 of this episode. And at the rate we're going, this might very well be our first ever 3-part episode. We shall see. But that's next week. Until then, I'm Wayne Davis and your role-playing history.